This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later this afternoon, a look at the Ruffed Grouse Society, a group with a deep respect for the birds they hunt and a vested interest in conserving their habitats. Starting us off today, last week we discussed the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp. Today we'll hear about another episode during that terrible time. During the Holocaust, Hebrew Union College played a key role in the rescue of college professors and students from Nazi-occupied Europe. From his office on the Clifton campus, then HUC President Julian Morgenstern orchestrated that rescue, saving 16 people from likely death in Nazi camps and ghettos. And here to tell about it are Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion PhD students Eva Mwanika and Kurt Backlund, who've done extensive research on the event. And good to see both of you this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kurt, set the stage for us. What kinds of hardships and perils were these 11 college professors and five students facing? What was it like for them?
Well, before they even came over, some of them were facing a pretty difficult time. They had been dismissed from jobs that they had held at institutions in Germany, and once dismissed, they were they couldn't find work, and they'd been trained as academics, so that you can imagine they were in a tough position. The Nazi regime had begun downgrading the status of different Jewish institutions, making it even more difficult for them to move to other places, because now they're on their resume, it said that they had teaching experience at a lower level institution. So prior to really getting out, some of them were, sort of becoming a little bit transient.
What was life like for them, Eva? What was going on?
Well, it was really challenging because when you think about it, you've been teaching at this, you know, institution of higher learning for a while, and then suddenly because of these laws that came with the Nazi regime, for example, just pushing Jews out of public life because they were not Aryan. There's a law that if you're not Aryan, you know, you couldn't serve as a civil servant in, you know, in various areas in public life. And so suddenly you don't have a job. And some of them were actually, for example, Rabbi Heschel was deported out of Germany to Poland because he was considered an alien Jew. So it was more than just a loss of a job. It was loss of everything you're familiar with, including your home and, you know, your environment. And so that's what happened.
Were their lives in peril as well?
They were, because some of them, especially around 1938, with what is called the Kristallnacht, the pogrom where, you know, the night of the broken glass, as they call it, where Jews were targeted, and there was violence, there was mass murder and everything. And so what happened was some of them were arrested and they ended up in a concentration camp. And some, because of the efforts of this project, this rescue project, now that they had evidence of assured emigration, because now they had an appointment in a school, some of them were able to get out of the concentration camp, but then they were not guaranteed a visa, but at least that saved their lives.
Kurt, how did Hebrew Union College become aware of these 16 people and the need to rescue them?
There was a lot of conversation that went back and forth between the president and a couple other leading Jewish scholars in Europe. There was Ismar Elbogen and Leo Beck, who were both heads of Jewish schools, and this was fairly early on, before most people were really aware of how dangerous the situation was going to get and how bad things were going to go for the Jewish community in Europe. As early as 1934, he was talking with some of these leaders, saying it would be a good thing if we could try to bring some Jewish students and maybe some professors over, because they knew that things were starting to get uncomfortable for the Jewish community, even though it wasn't at that point deportations and concentration camps. So we have, I don't know how many letters going back and forth. Samuel Krauss was another Viennese professor that Morgenstern corresponded with. Hundreds of letters going back and forth, trying to identify promising candidates to come over for these positions.
Eva, what were some of the other steps that President Morgenstern took to orchestrate this rescue?
Well, once he had the list down, the next step was to find out about the immigration laws. And he did this with a lot of consultation with the visa department at DC, trying to find out the meaning of, you know, what will it take for these scholars, and because, I mean, they're not American, to come over as students or as scholars. So that was a very crucial step. And he made a lot of trips to Washington, DC, trying to understand the stipulations and what was required for them to be able to acquire a visa. And when you think about it, the backdrop is during the war. And so there are a lot of challenges that came with that.
And Kurt, with the distance between Cincinnati and Europe, speaking of challenges and the limited technology at the time, how difficult was it to pull this off?
Well, I think it was one of the largest difficulties, I think, was, you know, the time, it was all done by letters, airmail. And I know they ran into some difficulties. They tried to send letters one way and they were returned, and you mm-hmm. have to send it through a consulate if you want to get it into an unoccupied territory in certain countries. There's a lot of time delay between correspondences, when you'd send a letter, when the person would get it, and when you would finally hear back from them. And during that time, regulations would change. The stipulations for getting a visa sometimes were altered as the war years went on. During the time that you were waiting for correspondence, a person could be forced to leave the city where they'd been staying and go into a different city or even into a different country, and then you have to find where they are and get mail forwarded to them at somebody else's house. There were a lot of different, it was just a very unstable time, and with the time required for letters, it was very complicated.
Yeah, and if I can add on to that, just because of the war, for example, in 1941, the United States closed its consulates in Germany. And I mean, the consulate is the first place you go to when you need a visa. So if this closed down, you're sort of left stuck. And there was also a lot of censorship of communication. You know, he needed to communicate with his scholars and their families. But as, you know, Kat said, communication was a problem. And also another issue, I think, which was really important, if you happen to have relatives in the occupied territories, you're denied a visa. One of the scholars was initially denied a visa because he happened to have a brother in Lithuania and a sister in Estonia, for example. And because these were occupied territories, because there was such careful supervision of people coming into the United States and the fear of, you know, spies and all that. So there's a lot of challenges. And think about, this is a small school in Cincinnati. It's not like a big project. It's during the Great Depression. This is in the 1930s. The school does not have much money and they have to keep going because, you know, they have this really clear objective and a sense of how urgent this situation is. And so it's amazing and it's a remarkable story that it was successful.
The visa issue, though, mm-hmm. sounds like that was maybe one of the biggest challenges that they faced in pulling this off.
Visa, in the context, we have to look at it within the context of the war and, you know, communication and immigration laws. Yeah, exactly. But we have to look at it in context. But it was a challenge.
Were all these people rescued simultaneously, or was this a step-by-step process that took, what, years?
Yeah, it started, as Kat mentioned, in 1934, long before anyone thought the Holocaust would ever happen. And this went on until 1942. That's when we have the last scholars arriving.
And Kurt, so Hebrew Union College hires all these professors and it creates scholarships for all five of the students, correct?
That's right.
And as Eva was pointing out, there wasn't a lot of money to go around. This was a tough thing for the college to accomplish, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And the school being a small institution, relatively, that was at the time limited to, it was rabbinic seminary, excuse me. Since then, it's grown into developing a graduate school of studies as well, and being open to non-Jewish students in the graduate programs. But at the time, it had a limited curriculum for the rabbinic students, and it required a fairly limited number of faculty. So they had no money to do this, and they had limited positions available. It required them to do a lot of fundraising. There were private donors, I know, and the National Federation of
Temple Sisterhoods.
Temple Sisterhoods, thank you, raised a lot of money to try to help their, you know, Jewish relatives, I guess, distant relatives in Europe. But it was very much a problem in terms of money. Yeah.
Did they have to adapt any rules, change any rules to make this happen?
Rules at the school, do you mean?
Yeah.
I don't think so. They began to expand the available curriculum to accommodate the people that they had. Some of the people wound up working in the library, cataloging documents.
Mm-hmm.
One person, for sure, eventually moved on to be a rabbi in a congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the professors, after getting their permanent visas, they were able to secure offers of employment at other institutions like Yale University and University of Pennsylvania, and so they were able to move on, which took some of the burden off of Hebrew Union College.
We also found documents that, I mean, all the scholars coming in, the school is small, they already have a faculty that's established, and some of the things they had to adjust was create positions for these scholars coming in, because they had to prove there was a need for them to come here and there was enough money to pay them. But what was interesting is that with every official letter that went to the scholar, there was a personal letter that Morgenstern wrote to them, making them understand you may end up here, but then you won't have as much teaching opportunity as you would like. You know, the issues for us to get you here. So it was like a private letter going on with an official letter.
So the bottom line, though, is this was a daunting effort, wasn't it? I mean, there was a lot of detail that went into it, and a lot of bureaucracy hurdles that had to be gotten past, and it was a lot of work, wasn't it?
It was, and I think Morgenstern did most of it himself. There wasn't a team of people working on this. It wasn't that Hebrew Union had a large administration where you have a number of people, you know, with different delegated tasks. Some people working with the State Department. Some people raising funds. Some people trying to find residential accommodations for bringing these people over. I think Morgenstern really undertook it all himself, which makes it even more impressive.
Yeah, and I mean, the Board of Governors, too. He had to get a lot of approval.
We
also see that, too. But as you're saying, you're right. Most of it was him traveling, writing correspondence, responding, updating, actually. With every meeting at DC, he would come back and update the scholars and their families about he also had to be a president of the school, so he had other things to do, and at the same time make sure this project was progressing.
And he didn't have his laptop or his smartphone to help him
exactly
with this.
Or an email to send and get back a response in a few minutes or something. It was all typewritten, waiting for mail, you know, snail mail, as you call it. Yeah, it was really remarkable.
It is an amazing effort. We'll continue our conversation about that local effort that led to an amazing rescue during the Holocaust. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. As a nonprofit public radio station, we rely on listeners like you for more than half of the station's funding. So if you're already a contributor, thank you very much. And if not, we're asking you today to make your very first contribution. You can contribute online at wvxu.org or wmub.org or by calling 513-419-7155. My guests this afternoon are Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion PhD students Eva Mwanika and Kurt Backlund, as we talk about how the college orchestrated the rescue of 16 people from likely death in Nazi camps and ghettos. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kurt, this is such a little-known story. How did it first come to your and Eva's attention?
At the end of last summer, the dean of the school, Jonathan Cohen, was looking for a couple graduate students to help research this project. It's part of the 140th anniversary of Hebrew Union College since its establishment here in Cincinnati. And it coincided with the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to do some something special for the International Holocaust Remembrance Day in particular, and then also some events throughout the course of the year to celebrate the school's 140th anniversary. So he contacted us and said, we've got this story in the school's history of the president doing this huge job in little Cincinnati to bring all these people out of Europe. I need some people to help me going through the archives. There's the American Jewish archives on the school's campus that have collected just immense amounts of documentation. So he asked if we'd be interested in that. We met with him and sat down and talked about some of the details. He gave us an overview of the story, which at that point I was unfamiliar with, and said, yeah, this sounds like something interesting. I'd like to help out with it.
Eva, how did you go about pulling together all these stories and all the information about people involved in this dramatic rescue?
Well, our first stop was the archives, as you mentioned. This is the American Jewish Archives, which was actually established in 1947. It's on the Cincinnati campus, and it was actually established with this goal of preserving documents and making them accessible to people who are interested in learning about Jews and, you know, Jewish traditions and history. So it's accessible and open to anyone. And we're fortunate as graduate students to be able to have access to that. And so that was our first place. And then trying to find out what has already been written about this. And one of the professors of the school, Dr. Michael Meyer, has actually written various articles about this issue. And so that was the first place we began. And then the next step was just going through boxes and files. And, you know, once that proved to be a little bit too much, we started taking photographs, you know, so that we can at least go back and have access to that, because you can only sit and read for so many hours. My eyes hurt every day, really, looking through those documents. And, you know, some are handwritten, and it's not always clear, you know, what you're reading.
And it's not always in English.
And not always in English. Most of them are in German, naturally, because most of the scholars were there. Some were in Hebrew. And so it was quite the process, but worthwhile.
How did you get through the language issues? Do both of you?
We're required to learn German and modern
and Hebrew
as part of our program.
Yeah.
But speaking for myself, my German is still at a pretty rudimentary level. So it was a slow, painful process getting through some of the letters.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Eric in Hyde Park. Good afternoon, Eric. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. Thanks for the interesting program. I knew Rabbi Marcus and Jacob Petrikovsky. I wonder, I guess they came over after the war. Did Hebrew Union continue this contact, this line to Jewish scholars in Germany? Thank you.
Thank you, Eric, for the question.
Well, our project was limited between the years 1935 and 1942. And so if they came after that period, we didn't get an opportunity to look into that. But I'm sure this project continued because the war was still going on and there are people who are still stuck. So, yeah, those names are not familiar. I don't know if they're familiar with.
Dr. Rader was the archives are named after him, the Jacob Rader.
Yeah,
Marcus.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with his backstory, mm-hmm. Which country he came out of. I do know that one of the German scholars, Leo Beck, who stayed in Europe during the war trying to help other people get out. He eventually made his way to Hebrew Union College and taught for a few years before mm-hmm. retiring. So there was a continuation of the lines of communication mm-hmm. and people coming over. And this was probably really American Reformed Judaism had its roots in Germany. Most of the original people in the movement were German immigrants. Mm-hmm. And Professor Morgenstern was actually the first president of Hebrew Union College who was not born in Germany. Mm-hmm. So there was a very strong link that existed, and I'm sure it continued after the war years.
Yeah, definitely.
Was there anything you discovered along the way, Kurt, that you weren't expecting, something that came as a surprise? Or Eva, if something struck you as you were doing this in particular?
Well, what really struck me is just the human dimension of it. You know, sitting there in the archives when you're holding these letters or they used to have cablegrams. I guess that was the equivalent of an email, the fastest way, telegrams, I think, Western Union, and you're holding them, and they have these urgent messages to be communicated, and you can sense the urgency of it. And for me, it gave me the human dimension of the whole project, over and above the bureaucracies and the negotiations that have had to happen at DC. It just gave the humanity behind it and the urgency of it, and how a school, a small school, stepped up and in such a moment and made such a difference. And that was really encouraging to me.
Kurt, one of the 16 people who was rescued was Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. And he had a remarkable life after that rescue, didn't he?
He did, yes. He came to the school as a very young professor, and I think he was shaped really strongly by his experiences in Germany with the oppression of the Jews, the mistreatment, the injustice. And when he wound up in the United States, he became involved pretty deeply with the American civil rights movement. And he's probably, he might be most widely known from his connections with Martin Luther King Jr. It was something that, and his daughter, who was here this past weekend, spoke a little bit about this. Her father was just never able to tolerate injustice. And he had a quote that the toleration of evil behavior was more despicable to him than the people who were perpetrating the evil in the first place. He had a very strong compulsion in his life to speak on behalf of anybody who was disenfranchised or mistreated or what have you.
And Eva, why is it important to tell this story today? Kurt was starting to get into that a little bit about standing up against evil. Is that why it's important to remember this?
I think it's important not just for the history of the school, and also, as you mentioned at the beginning, it's an unknown story, but I think it's also an American story. When you follow the individual stories, as we did, of these rescued scholars and students, and seeing how they came here and made such an impact. You know, Rabbi Heschel, you mentioned him, but then there were other scholars too, like Franz Rosenthal, who also were coming from war, but they also served in the U.S. war as translators because of their linguistic training, and they were able to join the strategic office and do translation for the war. Some also went back again to Germany as, you know, United States Army chaplains. And so it's an American story, it's a Hebrew Union College story, and it's something that without understanding the stories behind these people, we cannot fully appreciate their passion for social justice, how much they published about the issue. You know, it's a remarkable story.
Eva and Kurt, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion PhD students Eva Monika and Kurt Backlund. To learn more about the Holocaust, go to the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education website. Also, a new exhibit, Unlocking the Gates of Auschwitz 70 Years Later, opens January 30th at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. And you can find links to those websites at wvxu.org.